Hi, this is Terry Kuzma at the Penn State NAC Center, and I'd like to present materials and nanotechnology. Our topic for today is going to be micro and nanomaterials for bioapplications. So this is Unit 5, Lecture 1, and going to be biocompatibility and cellular overview. Okay, the introduction for today's note packet, we're going to take a look at nanomanufacturing and how it supplies many unique materials and processes for biological applications. These may range from nanoparticles for drug delivery to prosthetic devices. And really what we're going to take a look at today is nanoparticles for drug delivery the most. While we're doing this, it's necessary to understand how biological entities like cells interact with products crafted on a nanoscale. So that's our goal. So this packet will review basic biology with emphasis on scale and interface with materials. Then we'll take a look at common nanomanufactured biomaterials with some associated application. So basically our goal is to analyze the application, and our application is cells. So we have to take a look at how cells work, and then we're going to take a look at how the nanomaterials interact with our application, which happens to be cells in this case. So the first thing we would like to define here, looking at our outline, is biocompatibility. And what does that mean to us, and how would we use that word? So biocompatibility is the ability of materials to perform with an appropriate host response in a specific application. And what we're looking at here is the biocompatibility. And I think most people would say, what is biocompatibility? And if we would put some man-made material in a body, we'd probably want the body not to react. I think that's most people's first look at what biocompatibility is. And that's kind of incorrect. We want the body to react with the material, but with an appropriate host response. So for example, what we could do is we could have the body look at a material like a prosthetic device, like a piece of titanium for a knee replacement. And we could say that the body doesn't want to have that material in there, and it might form cells around it, like encapsulate it. And that's our goal. So really the body would in some way react to that material and start to form cells and grow bone cells to the titanium for a knee replacement. Likewise, if we would have another biomaterial like a catheter, a material that's engineered on a nanoscale, like a catheter, if we put a catheter into somebody like for blood, we wouldn't want the body to react with that. We'd want the body to ignore that piece of material. So it's what does the body want to do to the material? Does it want to react with the material, ignore the material? That's biocompatibility. But as engineers, we predict what the body's going to do and how the body will react. So to engineer the biocompatibility issue, the nanotechnologist must amalgamate an understanding of materials and biological response. And really, that's what we're doing today. We're taking a look at biology, and then how would this biology, or how do cells generally react with materials, and how can we predict that reaction, and then how can we go back to our workplace, the nanotechnology machine shop, and how would we machine or, you know, invent or create these nano devices and how they would interact with the body. So the first part of this packet focuses on cellular function. This allows us to appreciate biological scale and cellular activity. So that's really important. And, you know, why are we presenting this packet in nanotechnology? It's because nanotechnology works well with the size of biological entities. So they really go hand to hand, and it's certainly a useful tool. So the second part of the packet, which we'll get into in some later presentations, I imagine this lecture will take 2 to 3 presentations. The second part of this packet will examine the biological response to engineered materials at the nanoscale. So for biocompatibility, we have to look at the biological response to the engineered material and should consider both the short-term and the long-term response. So people refer to the short-term response as the acute response. It's the near-term reaction of the body to the biomaterial. The long-term response can be chemical release, chemical degradation, and shedding of particles. And usually we'd consider this for not like nano drugs or nano assisted drugs, but maybe this would be considered more for like prosthetic devices like a knee or something, a knee replacement or hip replacement. And I guess a fairly famous example of this would be A common material to use for those applications might be some type of cobalt alloy. And it seems that there's a small percentage of the population that has no short-term reaction to cobalt. They might have a short-term reaction to cobalt. Naturally, they'd be tested for that, and they wouldn't be applicable for a cobalt-based prosthetic device. But after a prosthetic device has been in the body for maybe a decade, then all of a sudden the patient might have a reaction to cobalt and become allergic to it. So that would certainly be a long-term response. And those acute versus long-term response, the time on that is not necessarily in days or years. It's according to the application. You know, so we could look at an acute response being in a number of minutes, or maybe that could be defined as a number of days. It depends on the application, but certainly important things to consider. So now let's take a look back at the outline here. And what we want to do for a while is certainly to get our heads around what we're doing with these biomaterials. We have to examine what the cell does. So we'll take a quick overview. And I say it's a quick overview. It'll take two lectures or so. But based on taking a class or 3 or 6 credits in molecular cell biology, it's a quick overview in comparison. But we want to, you know, get a good grasp of cellular interaction, and especially to take a look at scale, which is very, very important. You know, the size of what we're doing, the size of the cells. And then what we're going to do is just take a look at a generic animal cell and see what are the entities inside the cell and how we can interrelate those. You know, once we have those things defined, we can see how we can actually begin to move materials into the picture and see how those materials would interrelate with some type of animal cell. So now let's take a look at a cell itself and, you know, maybe go over some background of a cell and say, well, why are cells a certain size, et cetera, and you know, because that's certainly important. So the logistics of carrying out metabolism sets the limits on the size and range of cells. And I think it's interesting, as an object of a particular shape increases in size, its volume grows proportionally more rapidly than its surface. And the cells that we're most interested at are eukaryotic cells. They have a nucleus, and they're about 5 to 100 microns in diameter, depending on the function. And there's different cells. But I generally would say, if you know, in my mind, if somebody walks up to me over a cup of coffee and they said, you know, when you're trying to picture a cell, how big would a cell be? And I don't know. I just always think that, you know, just for reference, I'd always say that a cell is about 10 microns or so in diameter. Like a red blood cell is about 7.5 or so. So as an engineer, I just round that up. And just for a nice even number, I'm going to take a look at cells and say, you know, just as an exaggeration, I'll just say all cells are 10, just to get our heads around some kind of number as a reference. So, you know, let's look at the question, why are cells microscopic? You know, it's a very important question. And for objects of the same shape, the smaller the object, the greater its surface area to volume ratio. And, you know, that's an interesting statement because this is really, certainly in all the nanoparticle or nanotechnology books, this is the definition of what a nanoparticle is. You know, it has a huge amount of surface area to volume. And what that does is allows it to participate with the environment. And that's what cells do. So, you know, an important thing that we have to consider here is, why do we have this definition? And what does this definition mean to us? It means that this, you know, size and scale, it says that this cell probably wants to talk and interact with the environment a lot. I mean, I think you can say that from this definition. And certainly that's what needs to be done. Now, that's going to propose the question to us as material engineers. Now the cell is going to interrelate with its environment, and the environment that we're going to propose is a nanoparticle or some kind of nano-based material, nano-crafted material. So these cells are going to be able to see, taste, and feel what's going on because they actually have this high surface-to-volume ratio, and nature did that so that they can interact well with the environment. So it's that interaction that we're trying to take a look at. So why are cells this big, and what sets this? If cells were larger, the rates of chemical exchange with the extracellular environment might be inadequate to maintain the cell due to the great distance between the cell membrane and the nucleus. So again, this is a scaling issue, and it makes the cell basically efficient. So why are cells microscopic? So if we would take a look at like a big cell and divide it into smaller pieces, we would see that it becomes efficient. So let's do that mathematically. By dividing a large cell into smaller cells, the surface area to volume ratio is maximized. This serves the cell's need for acquiring nutrients and expelling waste products and interacting with other cells. So this relationship explains why larger organisms do not have larger cells, but they would have more cells, but of the same size. So how does this standardization of cell size impact nanotechnology? And I certainly think this is a deliverable message here. The universal size for cells means universal scaling, and this dictates the manufacturing tool set. So this means the same design algorithms and tools, you know, your lab, your processing environment, your materials, you would use the same tools and processing algorithms for mice as elephant cells. So the techniques and applications can be shared across the nanobiomaterial market. So I think that's interesting that, you know, the cells in a mouse are the same size and scale as a cell in a person. Therefore, we can do experiments on mice and extrapolate that data, at least initial experiments, and extrapolate that data to applications for humans and the market itself, too. If you have some type of discovery or drug-based or application that you could use in mice, certainly then you could use it in, you know, horses and people, et cetera. So it serves the whole role of a lot of different animals. It's very interesting. So mathematically, and we've done this many times in the nanotechnology courses, here we'll take a look at, larger, if we see on the left here, this larger entity, this is, 5x5. And if we would take a look at the surface area over here, and then we start dividing this into smaller packets, we can see that the surface to volume ratio is increased, and that's what we have. So that means that these particles like this interrelate with their environment more readily than this one. So this one tends to be more efficient at taking in and expelling, maybe if it was a cell, modeling these squares as a cell. This would be more efficient at actually taking in nutrients, expelling proteins, et cetera, expelling waste and sugars, et cetera, taking in sugars. So this would be a more efficient thing, number A. So again, this is the same things we've seen in a number of slides that describe, you know, nanotechnology, why nanoparticles are important. So again, to take a look at scale, let's take a relative look at particle sizes. And we would have something like a gas molecule here. A gas molecule is about 0.1 to 1 nanometers or so. A virus is interesting because in the world of nanotechnology, we are often making things on a nanoscale. You know, below 100 nanometers, things get intriguing because things like their melting temperature, reactivity, et cetera, get interesting. So, you know, in nanotechnology, we try to make things as big as a virus. I think that's a nice interrelationship. So everybody knows that we can do this. So now we know that, you know, mankind is working on things that are as big as a virus. So we could, you know, take a look and interact with viruses, et cetera. And then tobacco smoke, rather large, you know, 10 to 300 nanometers. And bacteria, I would say, you know, is in and about as big as a cell or something like that. And again, I said, you know, a cell, like a red blood cell or so, I consider those about, you know, approximately 10 microns is, you know, what I have in my head when I think about a cell. Of course, they're all different sizes and everything. And then flour and dust, et cetera. And I always say, for reference, because I like nice, even numbers, I always say a hair is 100 microns or so, because that gives us a nice scale at things. Of course, hairs can be different diameters, et cetera, but you know, in and about there. So, you know, I'm thinking nanoparticles, you know, from, you know, 5 to 100, you know, nanometers is an important thing to take a look at. Cells being 10 microns, and for a reference, you know, a human hair being 100 microns. You know, these are three things that I think about, you know, on a daily basis to describe nanotechnology. They're references to me. You know, certainly we would look at entities like as big as a virus. It could be like a plasmon. which we all know is a particle that when we shine light on it is going to re-emit light at a high intensity. So that's a nice thing that we could use for cell tagging. So these cell tags, like a plasmon, would be in about this, you know, that size range. And we would be able to put them into a cell that might be, you know, 10 microns big. Again, as a scale, you know, relative scale, that's what we're taking a look at. So, you know, nanotechnology in its essence. And the things that we're going to look at quite a bit today, the drug packets or the things we're going to look at further for cancer, they're going to be in it about as big as a virus. So the things that we're interested in, nanoparticles, et cetera, or other things that we're going to take a look at, drug delivery systems, they're about smaller than 100 nanometers and about that scale. So those are very interesting. So this is an important page. I really think, you know, something to take a look at as a foundation of nanotechnology. How do you understand nanotechnology? It's certainly you have to know the relative scale. So I think this is an important page to include. So now let's take a look at the animal cell itself, the generic animal cell. You know, so this is, no cell really looks like this. You're just taking a look and saying, you know, how can we identify some important things in a cell? And certainly you could spend a lifetime studying biology and molecular cell biology and trying to understand it. But we're going to try to bring out some main topics today and take a look at some important facets. And I thought this was a really nice picture that shows a lot of things that happen to fit into my presentation. So this is not a custom-made picture, but it ties in nicely with the things that we're going to present today. So it's very interesting, very colorful, nice picture. And one of the things that we want to take a look at is today, we want to take a look at, you know, the role of like self-assembly, and we're going to use that later on to take a look at some drug delivery things. But we want to take a look first at like these cell walls. So this is the cell membrane right here, this wall that you can see along here. And so that's the outer, this one I'm trying to draw in this pen. This is the cell wall. And a cell wall is actually a self-assembled material, and it's made out of some building blocks that we're going to take a review. And we also have a cell wall that's very similar around here, the nucleus. This is the nucleus right here, and you can see it's like a sphere if you follow this up. This is a cutaway. And inside here, we're going to have like the DNA, et cetera, so that's the nucleus. So there's a cell wall around the outer cell, and then there's actually, you know, other areas that are protected inside the cell, such as the nucleus. So that's what we're taking a look at. And right here, we have these little ports, and these ports are going to take things in and out of the nucleus. And we have similar ports that take material in and out of the cell. And maybe a good question to ask is, what material are they taking in and out, and what do cells do? And I think this is a big idea. Really, like cells, in some relative fashion, you can say, cells actually are like protein machines. And what a cell does is it makes proteins, and it imports and exports proteins, where proteins come to a cell. And this is on the nuclear envelope, but a protein can come down to this area right here, this area, this little tag in here. And what a protein can do is connect to this tag, and then what it would do is open up that port. So this tag right here shown in the lower left, that greenish thing, that could be like a receptor, and a protein comes down to that receptor, and it's like a key. And what that key could do is like open up orifices like this. And what that could do is let sugar in. It could let proteins out. So basically, they're like garage door openers. And you have to have the right key to let things in and out. So that's very interesting. And it really, you know, tells us what do proteins do? Proteins are the locks and the keys that make the cell work. So what do cells do? Cells communicate, work, the life functions are carried out by proteins. And these proteins are real interesting, and they often control those ports that we identified. So there's other things in here, and we can see off of this, the nucleus naturally, as everyone knows, houses the DNA. So the DNA is shown up in here. And what does the DNA do, or what can we discuss? What's the role of DNA? DNA, by analogy, is kind of like the hard drive in a computer. So it has all the programs, and all the things that a computer does. Naturally, you don't do all the things at once. So what the computer does, the DNA does, it has all the templates. It tells all the proteins what to do in the body. So I think that it's real interesting that the DNA that's in your liver is the same as the DNA that's in your heart. But your heart has a different functionality than the liver. So actually, the DNA strand is the same in both the liver and the heart. But what happens is, through RNA, or through the expression of a certain small section of DNA called RNA, what the body does is it says, I'm going to, you know, if I'm the liver, I'm going to go to the portion of the DNA hard drive and pull up the program. And the program, by analogy, would be that section of the DNA. And that's going to be copied by the RNA. So what the RNA does is it copies a section of the DNA. And that little section of the DNA is going to do something like liver functions or kidney functions or heart functions. So what that RNA does, it's like the program. So that would be like your web browser or PowerPoint or something. It would be a small one of the programs that's listed on the hard drive. And now what we're going to do with that program, calling the RNA by analogy a program, it's that generally the work is done, the RNA is done in the endoplasmic reticulum here. And what it does is we get our colleague, you know, in the body, it's called a ribosome. And what the ribosome does is it rides along this, it looks like train tracks to me, it rides along this train tracks of RNA, which is a small subsection of a copy of the DNA. And the ribosome rides along the DNA, and what it does is it collects information from the RNA, and it assembles, it goes three clicks. Three of these things, they're called codons. It goes three of these clicks. The ribosome rides three clicks. Then it goes out into this fluid. And what it'll do is grab some transfer RNA. And the transfer RNA is going to have on it an amino acid. And what the ribosome does is it logically rides this memory, like this program of RNA. It rides along. It goes three data bits. It knows what amino acid to grab out of this, you know, fluid that's inside the cell. It grabs the appropriate amino acid, and then it puts it on this chain. So then it goes three more clicks, and it puts another amino acid. So this is three clicks, one amino acid. Then it goes three clicks, another amino acid, another three clicks, another amino acid. So what the ribosome does is, looking at this program, it actually builds a protein out of amino acids. So basically, this is the thing that makes life happen. So why is DNA important? Why are proteins important? Because DNA is the hard drive. RNA is like a program. And then that program carries out some function for us. And the function happens to be a protein. Now this protein, what it can do is, now this, you know, this collage of ribbons right here, you know, in scale. This is certainly bigger just for view, but it can go back to here and it can open up this key. So this protein could go to another cell and open up and tell a cell to do something. So that's how your body operates. You know, you're told body can come in and say, another thing can happen is a protein can come in and then talk to the ribosome and say, hey, start making this particular protein. So you get a key from another cell that says, hey, I need some digestive juices. I need something. So it knows that, and then it'll create those things. So this is how your body works. So this is an interesting drawing. You know, layer here, these cell walls are maybe 30 nanometers or something like that. So that's an important thing to keep in consideration. And later on, we're going to discuss how we'd use man-made cell wall kind of things for drug delivery, which is very interesting. So form fits function. So from the previous slide of the animal cell, we looked at a generic representation of the cell. No cell really looks like that, but, you know, it's important to take a look at, you know, what does the cell do, or what does it perform, or how does it operate. So that was a nice example of that. So cells themselves are extremely diverse in appearance. They're modified for specific purposes, and they express functionality. And the functionality that they express is the small portion of the DNA that they actually express. So again, every cell has the same DNA, but the cell is smart enough so that it will only express a small portion of that DNA and express the functionality of that specific cell. So different cells themselves contain different amounts of organelles, as shown in the last slide, depending on the role they play in the body. Form fits function, and we select and modify materials to interact with the cell function. So again, we have to look at the cells and see how they function. And certainly you can see that, you know, maybe proteins have a role to do with functionality. And again, we'll reference this cell function, then relate this information with materials later into the note packet. So this is a bunch of different cells that we have in the body. And of course, they're all different sizes. And I said before that, you know, I would consider just a generic cell being 10 microns or so just for scale, because I think that's important to take a look at. But, you know, these are some of the main cells in the body, you know, erythrocytes, which are red and white blood cells over here, and osteocytes, which are bone cells, which are really important and certainly a concern with when we would maybe impose prosthetic devices like artificial knees and hips and stuff like that. There's muscle cells, certainly different sizes than bone cells. And then epithelial cells, which are important. These are linings. And I always picture these things, I think, you know, at least in my mind as a cartoon, these epithelial cells are like linings. And they look like shingles on a roof to me, you know, as I see in my head, you know. And then there's connective tissue that's used in the body, and then certainly neurons. And neurons could be rather large, et cetera. And certainly these are all different, but they share the same DNA, you know, and the portion of DNA that would be expressed by these cells are that small portion of RNA that is used to carry out whatever functionality that these cells perform within the body. So it's a very interesting and certainly a lifetime study, but we're just taking a quick view here so that we can get our minds around what we need to do for material interaction. So let's examine cell structure and related function. So some key points that we want to take a look at is the roles of proteins, because proteins carry out life functions. So proteins are the verb. They're the activity. They're the things that actually make life happen, most people would say. And then we will have to take a look at the role of what DNA does, and certainly DNA is the hard drive that goes back and creates and serves, has the memory that was go through the role of RNA as a link will take us back and create proteins. And then real important is cell communication and interaction with materials. And so that's what we want to look at. So we have to see how do cells communicate. Now when we would impose a man-made material, how can we have those cells communicate with the appropriate host response, right? The biocompatibility of that material. So let's take a look at the cell wall itself, because that's an important, you know, defining variable within a cell. And then the wall itself is made of a self-assembling phospholipid. And this is really important. So phospholipids are also a base used to create liposomes, which we're going to take a look at later. And we're going to take a look at these because they're used for drug delivery systems. And they're very, very important. And certainly one of the in the last 20 years, a huge breakthrough in cancer research, cancer technology. So the cell wall is made of a phospholipid sheet that has ports that regulate nutrients, waste materials, communication, and interact with other cells. So this is how the cells see and communicate and carry out life functions. And again, this, how they see, how they communicate, and how they carry out life functions, that's through proteins. So that's our currency of life is the protein. So proteins are the key that opens and closes these ports. And of course, the man-made materials must interact and communicate with these cells. So this is a generic membrane structure. It just gives us a look at the membrane structure itself. So this could either be the nuclear envelope or the outer cell wall, or it could be used as later on, we're going to take a look at it, might be without these ports. It might be something that we'd use to encapsulate drugs for delivery. So here's the lipid bilayer around here. And this area here might be around 30 nanometers. and then we have these ports, which aren't to scale, because I would say, you know, most people would say the average port that might be like a gap junction, et cetera, on a cell, they might be in and about 100 nanometers or so. So that might be something to, you know, not to scale on this drawing. And then these green things in here, they might be like proteins that are going to interact, or the key that we're waiting, or the lock, and wait for some protein to come down of the right size, interact with that, and then maybe open up this junction. So it's a nice look at the cell walls. And again, what we're looking here is the lipid bilayer. And what we have is on the outer side of this, on this side, we're going to have water. So these phosphate heads are going to like the water. And then we have these fatty acid tails in here, and they're going to fear the water. So here's the, they like water on this side, fear water on this side. So this is like the fat section in here, and this is the phosphate heads on this side. And there's two layers in here. This is a double layer. So these are hydrophilic heads and then hydrophobic tails. And what they're going to do is they're going to self-assemble. And for conservation of energy, what they're going to do is they'll fold into sheets naturally. And then from there, you know, efficiently, it's going to fold into some type of sphere. And then that's going to help us build our cells. So that's how cells are built, through that wall. So let's define, you know, this portion in here, these lipid bilayers. Let's look at the building block of that, which is a phospholipid. It's a natural self-assembly unit. The phospholipid is a molecule related to fat. The molecule is comprised of two parts. It has a hydrophilic water-loving phosphate head. So those, if we go back to the picture, they're going to like to go to the water. So that's the phosphate heads on here. And it's going to have two hydrophobic fatty acid tails. So everybody knows how oil and water like to separate. So this hydrophobic fatty acid tail, they're going to, you know, move away from the water interface. So naturally, that phospholipid is going to have a, you know, the water preferential end and a water fearing end. So when the phospholipids are added to water, they self-assemble. The phosphate head points towards the water, keeping the fatty acid tails away from the water, and this forms a bilayer. So these bilayers act as the cell walls. So that's really important. And, you know, this is a good example of self-assembly in nanotechnology. So let's take a look at the phospholipid structure. And there's a number of these. They could have different types of per se chemistry, and the fatty acid tails can be of different lengths. But, you know, we have the head here shown in this area. And this is the hydrophilic head. So these we're going to like to point to the water. And then we have the fatty acid tails down in this region here. And, of course, they could be of different lengths, et cetera, depending on the application. So going back to, you know, cell walls, et cetera, let's take a look at the nucleus and see, you know, as a cell wall, what this does. The nuclear envelope is also formed from self-assembled bilayers of phospholipid, like the external cell wall. It's the most prominent organelle in the body. The nucleus houses the DNA, which is responsible for protein synthesis, and the nuclear envelope protects the DNA. So since the DNA carries out or is the hard drive, we protect that. So we don't want that to be corrupt, because if the DNA is corrupt, then what that's going to do is make corrupt RNA. And if the RNA is corrupt, then the proteins will be corrupt. And if the proteins are corrupt, then they're not going to carry out the goal that they're meant to do. So, for example, if that protein would do something like be a digestive juice, if it was made wrong, then you wouldn't be able to digest your food appropriately. So the DNA has to, you know, over your lifetime, not be damaged. That's why it's housed in the nucleus. So the DNA is like a hard drive. It contains all the programs. So the body protects this so that it carries out your life functions for a long time. If your DNA gets corrupted by radiation or et cetera, then you'll make the wrong proteins and things could be bad within your life functions. So again, let's take a look at this animal cell to refresh our memories of what's going on. We have the nuclear envelope right here. And what this nuclear envelope is going to do is it's going to protect our DNA. And what our DNA is going to do is it's going to provide the hard drive, And what we're going to do is make a small portion of that, use a small portion of that hard drive of the DNA, and that's going to be like our little program, which is called the RNA. Then we're going to take the RNA out of the nuclear envelope, and we'll probably have it in the endoplasmic reticulum area. And what we're going to do here is we're going to have an assistant within a cell called a ribosome. And what the ribosome is going to do is ride along this little subsection of the program. And every 3 data bytes here, what it's going to do is know what amino acid to assemble into a polypeptide before a protein is active in a body. It's called a polypeptide. It expresses its functionality and bends and twists within the water. And what this ribosome does is goes out, grabs these different amino acids, and assembles them into this chain. So the chain of amino acids is a polypeptide. And once that polypeptide is functionalized within water and has all the bends and twists, now it's called a functional protein. And what a protein is it's a key. And for example, this protein, which is not to scale, but this protein could come over to this lock, fit exactly that size and shape, and then it would open up that gap junction. So that's what we're taking a look at as far as the generic animal cell. So the entire nucleus is separated from the cytoplasm, which is the rest of the cell, by a nuclear envelope. This is a double membrane lipid bilayer separated by a space of about 20 to 30 nanometers. So that's the thickness of the cell wall. The envelope is perforated by pores that are about 100 nanometers in diameter. They can be bigger or smaller, but that's a nice even number to remember. And these regulate the transport of macromolecules and particles. So they can take in nutrients. They can expel waste material. They can communicate with proteins. They can export proteins. So that's what these transport pores do for us. And naturally, for the nanotechnologist, these size parameters determine the material interaction, material process tool set, and characterization tools. So naturally, if you wanted to do something like place some material inside a cell, usually would have to be less than 100 nanometers, because that's the size of the port. I think everybody can grasp that. And that's nice for us, because if we wanted to do something like a tag, like a plasmon, we know a plasmon could be 50 nanometers in size. So now we know that we can actually probably transport plasmons in and out of cells. So that's easier said than done, but at least the scale is there that it could be done. So the nucleus itself, getting back to the slide, the nucleus itself houses the DNA that's packaged as chromosomes during cell division. I think everybody's familiar with that. So DNA and proteins, again, why do we care about DNA and proteins? So DNA is an excellent example of controlled self-assembly. So I think one of the things that we learn through nature is we observe nature and then try to copy what's done. So it's an excellent example of self-assembly, and we could use those algorithms to design other things. So DNA is transcribed, as I said before, so it's transcribed into RNA, which is a subprogram. So DNA is like the hard drive. This is a subprogram. And then we translate these through the activity of a ribosome into proteins. So then they become a different material. And then the proteins themselves carry out life functions. So DNA is a software or a template, and then proteins carry out life functions. We'll review DNA first and then take a look at how DNA is used to create proteins later in this, which we've already done, but we'll review it again. So DNA, chemically, DNA consists of a series of nucleotides. These are the building blocks of nucleic acids. They're made up of 5 carbon sugar deoxyribose covalently bonded to a nitrogenous base pairs, and a phosphate group. The phosphate head of one of the nucleotides is bonded to the sugar of the next nucleotide in line, resulting in a sugar phosphate backbone from which these bases project. And the bases that project are these codes, and then the codes themselves are codons. So to take a look at what I described before is the 3 consecutive nucleotides. These are called codons. So a codon is a strand of DNA or RNA that provides the genetic information to code for a specific amino acid that will be incorporated into a protein chain or serve as a termination signal. So this is what we're looking at. This is the DNA structure as we go along here. And these are the codes. The code could be this G, right here, this C, A, or T. And then if we would look, here's another. So if we would look, this is A, G, T. So this is A. And if we would look at this one, this is G. And then this one coming out is T. So these three, T, G, A, this would be called a codon. So it's three data bits. And again, this codon would represent some type of a amino acid. We wouldn't directly use the DNA. What we would do is split the DNA, and then we would make a copy of this section, which would be the RNA. So we just take half of the DNA, and we would make a copy of this specific area. And again, these would give us all the codons. And these codons, when they're expressed as amino acids, that gives us the functionality of being a protein. It's important here to take a look at, the scale. So the spirals, this area in here, like the diameter or the radius right here, is about a nanometer of in the DNA. And then between these turns, like a full spiral on here, is about 3.4 nanometers. And then sugar to sugar, about 0.34 nanometers. So these are all good things to keep our eye on as far as scale, etc. And we'll go to the next drawing more to see the more of what the codons are. So this is a look at one half of the DNA, and we can clearly see this is, the backbone here. And then these are the nucleic acids that stick out, the T, A, C, and G. And again, if we would consider these three, we would call that a codon. So the assembly rules of DNA, purines bond to primidines and vice versa via hydrogen bonding. They never bind to each other. So bonding always occurs in the following convention, A to T or G to C. Or it doesn't matter, it could be T to A, right? Or G to C. But it's this mirror that these are the only allowed state. We could never have an A and a G or a G and a T. It doesn't happen that way. They have to be considered in these fashions. So this way or this way. So this allows half of the DNA chain to be replicated, because if you know what half of the chain is, if you know T's and G's, you know what's on the other side, because it's a given. So that's a rule. So human DNA contains about 6 billion base pairs, which is amazing, and that carries out all of life functions. So nature uses 3 base pairs to define a specific amino acid, and these amino acids are coupled together to form functional proteins, and the proteins carry out life functions. So again, here's the self-assembly rule, A to T's or T's to A's, vice versa, it doesn't matter, or G's to C's or C's to G's. That's how these things bond together. And a lot of people would point out that this has, 3 hydrogen bonds, so it's more difficult to break than the 2 hydrogen bonds. So this is the codons that we were discussing before. So if we would look at the chain on RNA, et cetera, and the T is replaced by U there for some trivia, a different type of a nucleic acid. But if we would look at 3 data bits on the RNA, for example, CCC, then we would get this particular amino acid. If we would look at, AGU, then we're going to get this amino acid right here. So that's what the ribosome does, is it rides along the RNA, looks at 3 encodes, and then it would know the appropriate amino acid to assemble into a protein. Oh, and then there's important things, as pointed out before. Not only the codons make amino acids and proteins, but they also control the regulation. So we can have this AUG is the start codon. This is where the start of a protein is, where the proteins are created. And it says start from here, and now we're going to assemble a fresh protein. And then we have these codes. And these are stop or pause codons. And what they're going to do is they're going to say, wait, we're done assembling the protein and we can cut it off, or we're going to take a break now and finish the protein later on. So this is a nice picture that shows us, what we're trying to view today and the importance of you know, protein interaction. So this links codons to polypeptides to proteins. So codons encode the information for specific amino acids, and that's shown by these little bubbles in here. Again, we can go back. These are the amino acids. So this, like, ALA is probably represented in here. Let me see if it is. Yes, here's an ALA right here. So this area right here. So that would be this particular codon. So codons encode the information for specific amino acids. Polypeptides are chains of amino acids. And then proteins are made up of one or more polypeptide molecules, as shown over here. And proteins give functionality. We'll review protein synthesis later in the, you know, we already took a brief look at it, but we'll take a more detailed look at it. So this is the protein right here. It could be one or more polypeptides, and this is the polypeptide chain as they're formed. And it's a polypeptide until it's functional and it's going to do a job. So, you know, a polypeptide is actually like an incomplete protein or a protein that's not in its functional state. So this shows the primary structure. The secondary structure is when these things bend and twist in water. So this shows us where this, again, we'll take a look at, you know, the cell walls. So this is a cell wall again. And actually they're very complicated. And again, here's our lipid structure in here that forms the basis of the cell wall. And then within the cell wall, we have these communication proteins, protein receptors for protein that are all over the place and do different things. This could be a gap junction represented by this cartoon right here that we come down and maybe talk to this protein, and then this garage door would open up for us. These other proteins might just tell another cell to say, hey, I'm a bone cell. You're a bone cell. We're all in the right neighborhood, right? So this could be a communication protein that's on the outside of the cell just to say, I'm in the right location. I'm performing the right job within the body. That's very important. We look over here. This is the inside this interface. This is the cytoplasm of the cell. So this is inside the cell, and this is the outside of the cell on this side. So the cell wall is going to prevent communication or allow communication if it gets the appropriate signals to these receptors. And then things that are done within the cell is like making this protein. And then this protein can be exported in these orifices too. So we could come down with a protein, request this protein that's in here, this orifice would open up and then ship out that protein. So this is an excellent example of how nature does uses self-assembly and how it uses the communication of proteins to do interactions. So DNA itself, taking another look at this structure, we want to really pay important attention to the scale. So the native form of DNA is the double helix. It consists of two hydration strands held together by hydrogen bonds between the base pairs and wound into a spiral shape. The helix is about 2 nanometers in diameter. The base pairs are 0.34 nanometers apart. And there are 10 base pairs per turn of the helix. So again, this is the picture of DNA that we saw before. And again, it's important to see the size and scale of what we're doing in here. So this is about 2 nanometers from end to end across here, about a nanometer as a radius, and about 10 base pairs per turn. And again, these are the C's, A's, T's, and G's. And then 3 of these are going to be the codons. So what we're going to do is split this DNA up here, break the hydrogen bonds because they're easy to break. And then what we could do is take a section of this and copy it, and this could be our RNA. Or another reason that we might want to split DNA is if there's cellular division, like we want to make a new cell and clone a cell per se, what we would do is split the DNA in half. One half would go to the old cell, and the other half would go to the new cell, and naturally, through self-assembly, it would be a complete DNA structure again. It would form a new left or right hand half during cellular division. And later on, what we're going to do is take a look at, you know, when it splits to do that work, either make RNA or to make to clone the DNA so that a cell could split and then divide so we can have cellular division. So that means growth. What we're going to take a look at later is how we would lock the DNA together so that it can't split. And if it cannot split, then it cannot divide. And if it cannot divide, it cannot grow. That would be really good for cancer. So one of the most popular drugs that you could, or a form of drug that you could use for cancer, is to prevent cellular division just in the tumor. So that would actually keep the tumor from growing because, you know, one, I guess, look at what cancer is it's uncontrolled growth. So what we would do is inhibit growth by not allowing the DNA to split. So this DNA assembly is really nice because it's an example of self-assembly. So during cell division, the DNA split between the old and new cell. So there's an old, there's two old strands, and then it forms two new strands, but they're mirror images of each other. So before replication, the parent cell contains two complementary strands. So complementary means that, you know, it would be a T associated with an A or a G with a C. The parent cell's two strands are separated. Each old strand serves as a template that controls the synthesis of a new complementary strand. So each DNA molecule consists of one old strand and one new strand, resulting in two identical copies. And as I said before, later in this presentation, we'll look at nanotechnology that inhibits DNA replication as a means to destroy cancer tumors. And one of the most popular drugs, and certainly nanotechnology-based drugs, is Doxil. So Doxil is a drug that's going to do that for us. And, you know, what we're trying to do here, you know, for the note packet per se, is we're going over cells and, you know, cellular function so that we can understand how Doxil actually works within the body. So we have to first get our minds around, you know, what happens biologically, and then, you know, how can we make a man-made material such as Doxil that could do this? It could actually inhibit the growth of tumors. So that's really good stuff. So I think that this is a nice point right here to finalize what we're doing. So we're going to take a look at DNA replication, and then probably take a break for today, and then start in on a new note packet and further go over the role of DNA and protein. So this is DNA replication. What happens? We have the DNA as the familiar look that we saw before in the notes. It's coupled together. A's the T's, G's the C's. It's allowed. Then what we can do is during cell replication, we can have this helicase. What it's going to do is split these apart at the hydrogen bond in the middle. Then we're going to have an old strand and a new strand. And by the rules of self-assembly, T's goes to A's and G's to C's. If we only had this side, naturally we're going to know what the other side looks like. So out of the cytosol, we'll have other helpers in the cell that will help us gather this material. And now we're going to have two identical strands. So now there's a new strand, old strand, and now we have two sets of DNA instead of one. Over here, we're going to have two. And this is going to allow the DNA to divide so that we can have cellular division. So again, we're going to stop at this point. We went over some nice topics to look at. You know, how does the cell work? The cell works by protein interaction. So then we naturally have to say, how do we make this protein? And how we make this protein is from the hard drive called the DNA. And then the DNA, what it's going to do is a small subsection of that called RNA is going to be used to make proteins. And now those proteins are going to carry out life functions like identify the cells. So, there's going to be a protein on the outside of a liver cell saying, hey, I'm a liver cell. Because it's going to, you know, want to identify itself and its functionality to other cells so that it can interface with other cells. Likewise, we can have the same thing, which is very interesting and certainly good for physicians that treat cancer. Cancer cells are going to say, hey, I'm a cancer cell. That's really important because now we can actually locally identify cancer cells, because on the outside of a cancer cell, they're going to have locks and keys that are just indicative of what a cancer cell would be. So we can actually identify cancer by the proteins that it possesses. So naturally, since those proteins could now be considered locks or keys, we can actually send over the complement to that and maybe specifically be able to deliver drugs to specific sites like cancers because they have certain protein expression. So that's very interesting and certainly things that we're going to take a look at later in the presentation. So I'm going to conclude this unit today, and then we're going to start back up and we're going to go over and we'll have unit two, which is going to be a continuation of the discussion about proteins and cellular interaction. Thanks, and we'll see you next class.